Okay. Our next speaker is Sam Lipson. Sam is a trained toxicologist who serves as Director of Environmental Health for the Cambridge Public Health Department. He enforces the RDNA ordinance and laboratory biosafety regulation within Cambridge, which hosts over 90 biotech firms and institutions in an area of approximately 7 square miles. Mr. Lipson also serves on the steering committee for a climate change vulnerability assessment and climate adaptation plan, and bringing public health lens to a citywide effort. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I don't have one of those things, so I think I'm going to stand here. I don't roam too much, so I think it'll be fine. But I don't know how much time. I know there was a change in. Okay, great. Well, very happy to be here. Glad APHA had a lab session. I see we're mostly talking to ourselves. welcome to Boston for those who are from there. It's been a fun week. Wanted to bring this, it's a very different kind of talk. It's less about specific lab operational issues or management and more about kind of global oversight of laboratory, but feeding into laboratory safety culture for sure. It's an unusual story and one I'll try to tell fairly quickly because I know we don't have that much time. Back in the mid-70s when there was, let me get through the disclosure slide first, and then I can start talking. I'm over in the city of Cambridge, which is across the river. It is a different city than Boston, and it's a very small city. It has both Harvard and MIT, but it also has a very large biotech industry, so it's an interesting place to work. We have interesting problems, and never dull, I would say. I have no relationships to disclose in this case, so let me just go right into why it is we have a strictly enforced local recombinant DNA ordinance. In the mid-70s, for those who are familiar with biosafety, they're familiar with the conception of the industry, which really began in the late 70s, early 80s, but by the mid-70s, they first developed the technology to be able to use restriction enzymes to be able to splice sections of the genome into microorganisms. This was only being done in a very small number of places at MIT, at Harvard, at Stanford, I believe. It raised some serious concerns among, frankly, biologists before others who were even aware of it. And some of these concerns were addressed during the Asilomar conference, which was sponsored by the CDC and was intended to look at the unintended consequences of being able to recombine the genomic information inside microorganisms. They acknowledged a lot of areas where they simply did not know what the consequences would be, but began to set up some ground rules, which eventually resulted in the NIH having guidelines for research involving recombinant DNA molecules. That is background to the fact that in the same time, pretty much, 75, 76, in the city of Cambridge, there was a debate that became a raging debate. It was initiated by biologists who were working near others, or some of them working in the field of early field of genomic research, of gene splicing. And they basically said, there's no oversight here. There's uncertainty, and there's no way of really being completely confident or reasonably confident even about what the traits that would be acquired by microorganisms that have been recombined might be. So as the NIH developed their safety standards, actually, and in concert, believe it or not, they had a couple of joint meetings with the Cambridge City Council. At that same time, Cambridge City Council developed their own policy, which did result after a moratorium that lasted for part of a year, and a brief period where there was something called a Citizens Experimental Review Board. The City of Cambridge actually developed an ordinance in 1977, and then rewrote it in 81. This is intended to essentially bring the impetus for conducting appropriate and by the guideline, the NIH guideline, standards to laboratories that may not have directly answerable to the NIH. The important thing to keep in mind here is that if you're receiving NIH funding, of course, you have to comply with the NIH guidelines. They've improved enforcement over the last several years. There's been some criticism. But nevertheless, if you're in the private sector, you simply do not have to comply with those standards. This This is much more normalized today. So for folks who look at the biotech sector today and wonder what the big deal was about, a lot of knowledge has been acquired in that 35-year period that was simply uncertain at the time. This is a little blurry, but I wanted to just paint a general picture of how large the lab-based industry in Cambridge has become. It's a very, very dense city. It's the seventh densest city in the U.S., over 100,000. And so there's not a lot of room to put stuff. But as a result of clever planning on the part of MIT, they did acquire a lot of property that was some of the only undeveloped property in the city. And they've been able to leverage that to be essentially the landlords to a lot of the private biotech sector. But there are a lot of private land holders as well and developers. It's not even including the MIT and Harvard labs here, so you get a sense of just what the scale here is. It's quite large. I think, as Mary mentioned in the introduction, over 90 firms in Cambridge have permits under our system. So things have changed quite a bit, as I was saying. There's a great deal more confidence in the understanding of what really does impose risk and a much better understanding of what doesn't. And within the biotech industry, outside of academia, a significant amount of the work is really very low or insignificant amount of biological risk. There are continue to be chemical risks, radiological risks. There's some risk of cross-contamination, certainly risk of contamination of the product being developed itself. But a lot of the varied techniques involving the production of non-replication competent organisms through gene splicing have allowed the industry to operate with model cell systems that basically allow work to go on without there being a risk of pathogenicity, and that's extremely important. I know that this is a short talk, so I'm going to go forward a little bit more quickly, but one thing that's really clear from my perspective is that this concern dissipated. It dissipated because the industry became normalized and because other issues arose, then displaced those. Sometimes it's just a matter of what is grabbing the attention of the public at large. But I would say the fact that there was oversight locally had a good deal to do with the comfort level that the city has enjoyed with respect to that industry. Not a city that's necessarily that tolerant of a profit-based risk that the community might be taking on behalf of others. And so a great deal of skepticism has emerged over the years, and it has come in waves. Often it's triggered by other outside factors. For instance, we had an enormous surge in interest and concern in Cambridge after BU agreed to host the BSL-4 laboratory, the National Emerging Infectious Diseases Laboratory, which is just now coming into a final approval after years and years of lawsuits. But it triggered a whole new wave of concern about the biotech sector in general in the Boston area, and it was a very interesting time. I'm going to skip over some of this. I think what I meant, what I'm really intending to say here, is that Cambridge has benefited from having taken an early and very strong position, which was based on the emerging best practices that the NIH was putting together, and has in fact merged in a lot of ways those best practices with industry best practices. They're not strictly regulatory in many parts of the country, but because of their shared values around safety culture, around accountability and transparency, training, the use of IBCs as a critical element in biological safety culture within a laboratory or a company, that it's not been an uncomfortable fit and clearly has not been a deterrent to the industry coming to Cambridge. So I think I'm going to just skip ahead a little bit here. The purpose, obviously, is fundamentally, as per the City Council, to comply with the NIH guidelines. I think it's fair to say that that worked very well for us until it became clear in 2009 we had to re-examine our ordinance because it was very clear that a good deal of the risk that was a general concern to the public had nothing to do with raw recombinant technology. That was no longer a fear-triggering word for people in the public at large. It had to do with non-recombinant work. And because of the context in which that ordinance had been written, very little attention has been paid to biological risk outside of the COVID network. And the Boston BL4 lab, again, was a trigger here because we had to, in all honesty, report when asked by the media, as we were for a period of time, if we could allow BL4 laboratory in Cambridge. And the fact is we could, because there was no restriction against work that was not with COVID. There was no regulation whatsoever. So in 2009, we basically promulgated a regulation, a local public health regulation, that they, I call it the donut, around the existing ordinance that expanded the oversight as the public health department to include non-recombinant work at a high risk level, not very much of it. So I do a time check. I think we've got only 5 minutes, something like that. For those who are not familiar with the biological side, I know a lot of chemosafety folks here. We have concepts that are reinforced throughout biosafety that are really important, and really important for the people who work within the Cambridge system of oversight to understand, because we have not only me as a lab inspector, we have our committee that actually votes to approve all permits in the city, and that is a residence committee, although often technically adept. They are, in fact, residents who have full authority to grant permits. And we have a requirement that community members sit on institutional biosafety committees within each company. And so the teaching requirement is high on trying to make sure that everybody's on the same page with this. And these are some of the central concepts that I try to, when we have teachers at the city council or when we do trainings for our community representatives, we talk about these concepts. Biological containment has to do with the kinds of alterations of the organism, the microorganism in most cases. This is capable of preventing that microorganism from reproducing or working with a strain which is stable environmentally or which has been deprived of certain growth factors or where certain routes of infection are not available because of alterations that were made to that microorganism. These, in general, are by design and often commercially available, and they do reduce the risk of the work enormously. It'd be hard to describe how much that reduction has occurred since 30 or 35 years ago. Primary containment, of course, safety cabinets and good practice and PPE. And then we do have secondary containment, which is more relevant in a BSL environment where you have to have an airtight envelope. So I think since there is very little time, I just want to, we talk about within biological work the risk groups. This is part of the slide presentation that I gave to City Council where we tried to explain the differences between the risk groups and also the differences between what the risk group being as the inherent risk posed by that microorganism because of its pathogenicity, capacity to infect people and cause an illness, either where there's ranging from risk group one where there's no illness whatsoever associated with that work, to one which is highly lethal and for which there's really no therapeutic intervention. So not all biological work is created equal, and it's very important for people who don't work in the field to understand the range and the nuance a little bit so they can accept a little bit that the risk assessment work that goes on internal to these organizations is a meaningful process. So lab, you know, this is something, again, I talk about when I try to emphasize the difference between individual lab worker risk and some of the factors which could escalate the risk to the community at large. I'm going to skip a little bit through that. We work really closely. I talked about our committee, and that is the Cambridge Biosafety Committee, which is a residence committee. I chair that, but they really have the granting authority for permits. We work also with these IBC reps I mentioned earlier, and we do train them every other year. We do a training for the community at large and try to recruit new community members to participate in this way. Companies have to come and present in these Cambridge Biosafety Committee meetings when they seek an application and under certain circumstances when they're seeking an amendment to that application. We offer a template so that people who are coming understand what level of detail we're looking for and try to make, you know, calm them down. Very often they're used to dealing with investors groups and scientific peers, but they have no history or experience in coming into a municipal committee and trying to know what it is that they actually want to hear or what their level of technical knowledge is themselves. Work closely also with the fire department. They tend to follow up on chem safety issues, and it's been an extremely good partnership, which I think is probably plays out in a lot of local jurisdictions, or hopefully it does. So these are some of the elements that we require that companies that come to get a permit present to our committee. And we pepper them with questions and jokes and tell stories about issues that have occurred in other labs and sometimes push back, sometimes hard. It's rare that we have to because the overall degree of interest and concern about biological safety, about staff medical surveillance is extremely high. It's been a model industry, and it's rare that we run into a situation where somebody hasn't exceeded what we hope to see. Admittedly, that is primarily the private sector, and on the academic side, as those of you who work in academic laboratory environments know, there's been a very long haul. It's been a long haul from a fairly poor culture that's improved in a lot of institutions quite a bit over time, but the work never stops for those guys, and I don't know how hard that work is because you're getting turnover constantly, and you have a lot of big egos, and so our relationship with the labs at MIT and Harvard has to be a little bit different than the private sector. We work very closely with the environmental health and safety programs in those schools and try to offer leverage to those in-house biosafety people, basically saying, we can threaten people, please threaten people. We'll come in and you can enforce those if you'd like. But we also mostly just have to rely, because of capacity issues, on their ability to carry out their programs as well as they can. So that's about it. I probably went a couple minutes over. These are some of the major events that have shaped, I think, in the last 20 years, the perception in the public at large, at least as it affects me, and some of the things that we've tried to accomplish also in the Cambridge and Boston area. We really did have a change of awareness of the public about agents, of biological agents, and intentionally released that get deeply into the imagination of the public at large and has frankly added a whole layer of concern to some of the work going on with, it's just essentially public health work in many cases at the BSL-3 laboratories in the city. I'd say the biggest issue around the BSL-4 lab is simply that a lot of public health people have pushed back over time and said, this work is not primarily public health, the highest priority public health work, so it really shouldn't be sold as such. And there were a lot of issues that were raised in the manner in which it was approved and the manner in which public input was received. So hopefully this will work out and the city will hopefully provide a good model for how to deal with such a laboratory in its midst. But I'm gonna stop there and thank you very much.